Meditation isn't a magic pill. You can't just squeeze your mind into a technique and expect the technique to do all your work for you. You've got to develop a lot of the proper attitudes toward meditation, the proper attitudes toward your mind. In addition to developing several techniques, so you can figure out what technique to use at what particular time for which particular problem. And so that you can use the techniques for their intended purpose. They're not meant to be straitjackets for the mind. They're more means of exploration. As the Buddha once said, he points out the road, but it's up to you to follow the road and to see what you learn. And in many cases, the techniques actually pose more questions than they give answers. So you've got to develop the right frame of mind for picking up the question and figuring out how to get the right answers. Answers that help put an end to suffering. And to get a good idea of what these attitudes are that you need to bring to the meditation, it's good to look at the way the Buddha taught his son, Rahula, prior to teaching him how to focus on the breath. There are two main sets of instructions. In the first case, the Buddha started his meditation instructions not by telling Rahula to sit and close his eyes, but to develop the right attitude towards all of his actions. In other words, he was going to get practice in how to be a meditator by looking at his actions in all sorts of situations. First, he established the principle of truthfulness. If you're the sort of person who feels no shame at telling a lie, he said, then you have no value as a meditator. If you find it easy to lie to other people, it's going to be easy to lie to yourself. So truthfulness was the first principle, the first attitude. And then he said you apply that to your actions before you act. Make up your mind you're going to act only on harmless intentions. So when an intention comes up and you're thinking about following through with it, ask yourself, is this going to be harmful? If you can foresee some harm, then you don't do it. If you don't foresee any harm, then you go ahead and do it. Why you're acting. Look for some of the immediate results that are coming, because actions bear the results not only off into the long-distant future, but sometimes right here, right now, you can see. You stick your finger in the fire, it hurts right now. It's not going to hurt in your future lifetime. But if you don't see any harm either to yourself or others, you can continue with the action. When the action is done, if you realize that it did cause harm over time, then you develop an attitude of shame about the action. Now notice the Buddha's not saying to be shamed about yourself. Feel shame toward the action. In other words, view it as something beneath you. That's a healthy use of shame. Make up your mind you're not going to repeat the action and then go talk it over with someone you respect. That develops the principle of integrity, that you accept responsibility for what you've done and you're open about what you've done. This way you can learn. So the Buddha starts out not by telling Rahula not to make mistakes. He says try to avoid them, but if you do make a mistake, this is how you handle it. With honesty, with harmlessness, an attitude of harmlessness or compassion and integrity. If, on the other hand, you look at your actions and see that you haven't caused any harm, you can take joy in the fact and keep on practicing. That's how you start meditating. in your daily life. Those are the attitudes you want to bring to the meditation. A willingness to look at your intentions and to look at their results. This is going to be really important in the course of your meditation, because there's no other way you're going to be able to read your mind. Then at a later time, the Buddha taught Rahula breath meditation. But before he taught him breath meditation, he taught him 10 other exercises to prepare him for the meditation. The first four exercises dealt with the physical elements. So look at the body in terms of elements, its properties. Earth or solidity, water, liquidity, fire, heat, wind, motion. So try to make your mind like each of these elements, each of these properties. For example, with earth. You throw disgusting things on the earth doesn't react. You throw nice things on the earth doesn't react. Now, the Buddha is not telling Rahula simply to be passive like a cloud of dirt. He's saying, be grounded. Learn powers of endurance. Because as you'll see, the meditations that he taught him further on are active kinds of meditations. You don't simply sit there with whatever's there without any idea of making changes. But if you want to make the proper changes, you have to first understand where you are, what the problem is. Then make your changes, and then watch to see if they work. Now, to be able to watch, to see things clearly, you have to have powers of endurance. Because unpleasant things are going to come up in the meditation, for sure. And to comprehend them, and after all, that is the duty with regard to suffering and stress, you've got to comprehend it. There are times when you have to really sit with it, to watch it over time, again and again and again. This requires endurance. Then when you try something in the meditation, experiment, changing this, changing that, you've got to sit with it again for a long period of time to see if what you did really works. You don't want to be the sort of person who makes a little change and sees a little something that looks promising and immediately jump to the conclusion that this is the solution. Because the result may be short-lasting, and you may be back where you were to begin with. You want to see that. So you've got to be able to sit with things. The same principle applies with the other elements. Fire can burn pleasant and unpleasant things, and it doesn't treat them any differently. Water can be used to wash away pleasant and unpleasant things. It doesn't treat them any differently. It doesn't react. Wind blows pleasant and unpleasant things around and doesn't have any preferences. The important thing is that you learn to be grounded. Remind yourself that whatever comes up, you can bear it. Remember once when I was staying with a John Fu, he told me out of the blue one day to sit and meditate all night. My immediate reaction was that was not a good day for me to try that. I'd been working hard that day, and I said I couldn't do it. He looked at me and he said, well, is it going to kill you? I said, well, no. He said, well, then you can do it. That's the attitude you've got to have. As I say, what doesn't kill you will make you stronger. Then in the midst of that, you've got to figure out, how can I get through this without suffering? And that's where you start learning how to be ingenious. But the important thing is that you remind yourself that, okay, you can stand this, whatever's coming up. You're not going to get blown around. And that way you're going to be able to trust yourself as an observer. And to show that the Buddha wasn't teaching Rahula to be passive, the next four meditations are about replacing unskillful attitudes with more skillful ones. essentially the attitudes of the Brahma-Viharas, goodwill, compassion, empathetic joy, and equanimity. Although here the Buddha is not asking him to develop to the extent of a Brahma-Vihara, but just noticing if ill will comes up in the mind, trying to counteract it with goodwill. You don't just sit there allowing the mind to stay with its ill will. You do what you can to foster an attitude of goodwill to whoever the person may be. If the idea that you'd like to be cruel or harmful to somebody comes up, well, then you counteract that with an attitude of compassion. You remind yourself that you're not going to benefit from their suffering in any way at all. In fact, if other people are suffering, that's when they tend to do crazy, unskillful things. You've got to have some compassion for people who are engaged in unskillful activities. And empathetic joy is when you feel feelings of resentment for somebody else's good fortune. You realize that this doesn't do you any good at all. If people are enjoying good fortune, they must have done something sometime that leads to their happiness, so why resent it? Feelings of equanimity are meant to counteract feelings of irritation and aversion. You want to be skilled at giving rise to these attitudes when you need them. So you don't just sit and wallow in unskillful, harmful attitudes. Similarly with lust, the Buddha said, try to develop the perception of the foulness of the human body. This is not having an unhealthy negative image of the body, it's actually having a healthy negative image of the body. You realize everybody is in the same boat this way. We're all filled with blood, pus, contents of the stomach, contents of the intestines, all kinds of stuff that you would not like to have out on the floor here in the morning when we're getting the meal ready. This is a useful antidote for when feelings of lust come up. When you think about what lies under the skin, it's hard to maintain sexual desire. So again, the Buddha's not teaching Rahula to be passive or simply to accept whatever's coming up. He says you've got to be able to counteract unskillful attitudes. And then the final preparation before he actually taught him breath meditation was something that's usually considered to be a very advanced teaching. He says, try to have the perception of inconstancy to counteract the conceit, I am. Now notice that what is putting in here right at the beginning and one of the reasons for this is that when skillful and unskillful things come up in the mind, if you immediately brand yourself as, I am the sort of person who is always skillful, or I'm the sort of person who is always unskillful, that's going to get in the way of actually seeing what is skillful and what is unskillful in the mind. Something that looks unskillful comes up and you immediately react to it. Say, oh my gosh, I'm a really bad meditator, miserable, look at this horrible thought, I shouldn't be having this. Either you feel self-hatred or you start going into denial. You deny that it actually happened at all, and that doesn't help. Get any insight at all. You can't see what's happening, you can't see whether the intention actually was skillful or not, and you can't see the results of that action, and you certainly can't counteract it if you don't admit that it's there. Or if you build the other kind of I am around it, that I am miserable, that really shoots you down, saps your strength and trying to counteract whatever it is. This is the problem with I am. It starts getting to issues of innate nature. If you have an innate nature, you can't change it. Similar problem with skillful things when they come in, arise in the mind. Something looks skillful, you immediately take it, read it as a sign of your innate goodness. You start getting complacent and careless, and you don't really see, you know, is there something unskillful lurking behind the surface? Where does this particular intention really lead? What needs to be done with it? You just decide that it's part of your innate Buddha nature or whatever, and then get complacent. So again, you miss out on things. You don't really see things as they're happening because the I am gets in the way. It's interesting that the Pali word for conceit doesn't mean only a sense that you feel better than other people. Sometimes if you say, well, I am worse than other people, that's conceit as well, because you're still building the I am around things. There's several ways to get around this. One is that whatever comes up in your mind, remind yourself this happens to everybody. Remind yourself also that you don't have any innate nature. The mind is neutral. It just knows. The thinking is skillful or unskillful, but those are habits, which aren't innate at all. Or you can do what the Buddha did. This is something that people tend to forget when they meditate. He started out, and that first knowledge of the night of his awakening was about himself, his narratives. And you think you have narratives. He had narratives that would go way back for aeons and aeons. But he didn't jump straight from there to the present moment. He took a detour, thought about all the beings of the world. How about them? And so that they went through the same patterns, all different kinds of births. And seeing them in a more universal way, he was able to see underlying patterns. What kind of actions were skillful? What kind of views underlay skillful actions? That led to fortunate and led to fortunate rebirths, and how unskillful actions led to unfortunate ones. It was by looking at the large picture that he was able to see patterns. Then he could look at the present moment from the perspective of those larger patterns. That helps cut through the I am, or the individual narratives. You're looking at events that are common to beings all over the world, when you're looking at greed, anger, and delusion in the mind. That helps to loosen some of the sense of identity. Another way to do that is to look at the mind as a committee. All kinds of things are proposed in the committee. Just because somebody has proposed a bad idea doesn't mean the committee's bad. The duty of the committee is to figure out what's the best thing to do right now. If they make a mistake, they go back and they undo the old decision and come up with a new one, without worrying about the innate nature of the committee. When you can see events in the mind in this way, then you're really ready to meditate. Because they're just that, just events, instances of intentions, or the results of intentions. And when you get up, get rid of the I am, you're in a much better position to see things for what they actually are, what they actually do. It was only after the Buddha taught Rahula all of these things that he sat down, okay, now this is how you do breath meditation. So when you sit down to meditate, it's good to reflect on these attitudes. Remember, these are among your tools. They're means for putting the mind in a position where it really can read the events that are arising and passing away. And also read the results of applying different techniques, so you figure out which technique is useful for which kind of issue. What's getting results, what's not getting results. And that's how you develop your discernment. You see cause and effect. Skillful and unskillful, i.e. the Four Noble Truths. You develop the path so you can comprehend suffering and eventually let go of its cause. That's how you realize the end of suffering. By experimenting, by exploring, by bringing the right attitudes and the right mental qualities to whichever meditation technique you choose. It's those qualities that make all the difference. So do your best to bring a full set of mature qualities to the meditation. That's how you get results.